Good evening, Fred. My name is Jack Brennan. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dad.
Hi, y'all. This is the first hotel or motel I've ever been in that they have a piano in the men's room. I was in a hurry going out there, and there's a sign that said restrooms, and I wound up in a lady's sauna. I thought that it was kind of big for a men's room, you know. I'm sorry that Ramona didn't tell you about the little Indian maid that went to college, and she came back home for a summer vacation. Of course, the old chief, her father, was saying that had the train waiting for her like this. And the young lady got off the train, and it was quite obvious that she was quite pregnant. And she said to her father, "How?" And he said, "Never mind how, who?" She didn't tell you what a papoose is either. Papoose is what an Indian maiden wins when she takes a chance on a blanket. And that reminds me of the alcoholic that went into a bar. And he said to the bartender, "Give me a drink. Give everybody in the bar a drink. And you have one yourself." So the bartender did that, you know, and it came to $18.50. And poor Lushy had no money. They wrapped him in the head with the ice packer and threw him the hell out, you know. Half hour later, he was back again. And he said, "Give me a drink. Give everybody in the bar a drink, but nothing for you. You get nasty when you drink." Then it was the poor soul that she never knew about Al-Anon over in Ireland, you know. And she went to the priest and she was crying. And she said, "He's drunk again, Father." And the priest said, "Oh, no. Oh, no, my God." And he says, "Mary, I don't know what to tell you." He said, "It's terrible. We've done everything in God's creation to keep this man sober. Now he's drunk again. I don't just know what to tell you." So he said, "Well, I tell you, listen. Why don't we try to scare him to death? To scare him sober?" He said, "You know, you live in a little house, and it's at the end of a lane, and there's bushes on both sides of the road." He says, "Why don't you tonight get out in the bushes and put a big sheet over your head? And when he comes down the road, jump out, wave your arms about, scare him, tell him you're the devil." So here's this poor sad soul. Midnight, she's out there hiding in the bushes. Come on, about you. She got a big stupid sheet over her head, and she's watching for himself to come down the road, and here he comes hitting both sides. And he's thinking he's having a ball, and when he's about 10 foot from her, she jumps down and she says, "I'm the devil, I'm the devil." And he says, "Oh, let me shake your hand and marry your sister." Now, you know, I could stand over here all night and I could tell you a lot of funny things, keep you laughing, wouldn't need a damn thing, because I didn't come down here to make you laugh. I came down here because there's a reason for my being here. And the reason is that there's somewhere sitting out there one alcoholic who needs to hear what I have to say tonight. I don't know who you are. I don't care who you are, but you damn better listen. Because you know them big iron birds that I come down on, I don't like. I think flying is for the birds. And they stumped me in that damn thing in Kennedy Airport. And you know the one thing, I can't use the men's room on a plane. It took 4.5 hours to get here. The stewardess, you know, she said, "Are you nervous?" And I said, "No, not really." But I didn't tell her why I had to go and couldn't. So I came down here tonight to speak to you, whoever you are, because that's the way the man upstairs wants it. I'm not a fool. I know damn well and good that everybody here is not going to run out and stay sober because I was here.
No.
But I do know that the man upstairs does work. And he works through simple people like myself. And we carry the message of AA to other alcoholics. And there is one reason for me to be here tonight. So you listen good, and the rest of you sit there quietly. You gotta cough, cough now. Because I don't want to miss it, but whoever he is. I have seen a lot of miracles in AA. I'm a miracle. And I walked in here tonight, I saw another miracle. I saw a young lady that 10 years ago could get out of a wheelchair, and tonight she walked over to me and said hello. But if there's anybody out there that can tell me that AA don't work, you better see me out in the parking lot after the meeting, I'll straighten you right out. You see, I'm an alcoholic, I said that when I stood up here. That was not me, I was just... Most important thing in my life is that I'm an alcoholic. Doesn't matter what my name is, I'm just another guy. But the fact that I know I'm an alcoholic, and I'm at an AA meeting, that proves something. Because you see, until I found AA, I didn't know who I was. I didn't know where I belonged. And I was completely useless, helpless, and hopeless. And when I came to AA, I found out that I had a disease. And so the most important part of what I'm going to tell you tonight is not who I hurt or too much of what I did, but that I'm an alcoholic and I suffer from a disease. And I belong in this world. I belong here just as much as anybody. And because I have a disease, there's no reason for me to wear a hair shirt and to hang my head. Because I did nothing to acquire my disease. I did absolutely nothing. Oh, I drank. But everybody drinks. But there's only 5% of the world that are afflicted with the disease that I have, and when they drink, trouble. So you see, the man upstairs caused me to be an alcoholic because he was the one that controlled my bite. Had nothing to do with my mother, had nothing to do with my father, had nothing to do with the place that I lived, had nothing to do with my sex, nothing to do with my age, had nothing to do with nothing except that I was born with a deficiency in my glands. And if I had a deficiency in certain other glands, I would be called a diabetic. And I could walk about the world and I could tell people what I'm a diabetic and they would quite understand and everything would be fine. But when I say that I'm an alcoholic, people say, oh, no. And I say, oh, yeah. Well, what the hell did you expect, Sue Hedge? And you know, sometimes I get a little rambunctious. They call me the uncouth one. I don't know why, really. I'm really a very couth fellow. It's just that once in a while, normal people upset me. And I resort back to what I used to be. They don't like that. So then I tell them, you know, well, if you like me the way I am, just leave me alone. Because I don't understand you, and you'll never understand me. And so we have a kind of an armed truce going between myself and everybody in the outside world. And it's a fine way to live, because I found how to live. I don't need anybody except my people here in AA, my friends. And I come to AA with much gratitude. And I allow them to strap me in those stupid seats on them big iron bugs, and I go because I'm grateful. Not because I like to get up here and talk. Not because I like to be away from home. Not because of any reason, but I know that I am alive because the man upstairs chose to leave me stay alive because he had work for me to do. And he wanted me to go wherever I would call. And wherever I'm called, that's where I go. And I don't care when it is, if it's humanly possible for me to be there, I'm there. And when I get home, I have such a good feeling because I feel that I am an instrument of higher power. And they say that this is a God-given, God-inspired program. And I believe it with all my heart. Because I have watched Edmund walk. And I have watched homes be reunited. And from my own experience, I know that there is nothing impossible to the higher power. And I don't care who you are, what kind of trouble you got sitting out there, it makes no difference in this world. If I can be sober, you can be sober too. And if I can have the faith that I have, then you can have the same faith. If you will care to take it. I have enough faith for everybody sitting here in this room. This program works. And if there's anybody out there that doesn't know who he is, doesn't know what he is, doesn't know where he's going, just stick around, you're in the right place. You belong here. This is a God-given, God-inspired program. And 38 years ago, it all came about. And if you'll notice that in previous to 38 years, and since 38 years ago, there is absolutely nothing new. The disease of alcoholism has been with us for many, many years. The Chinese have recorded alcoholism as long as 3,000 years ago. They said then that a man takes a drink, and a drink takes a drink, and then a drink takes the man. 3,000 years ago, the Chinese knew what alcoholism was. And 38 years ago, anyone afflicted with the disease of alcoholism was a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic, and he was dirty enough officers. He was no help for him anywhere. Science couldn't help him. The church couldn't help him. And nothing could help him. Aside the prognosis of helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic was a ticket to death. And yet, 38 years later, because of a miracle that happened, then we all sit here and we enjoy a lovely meal, lovely friendship, and there are groups like us all around this country numbering some 500,000 people. 500,000 people that should be dead and gone because of a miracle that happened 38 years ago. When Bill Wilson cried out in the depths of despair, if there be a God, let him show himself now. Not tomorrow. Now. Now is when I need you. And I say from the depths of despair, because this was a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. He was doomed to die a nameless death. And no one would be sorry that he left, because he was unemployable. He had lost everything in this world that a man could lose. And he was at death's door, or would be shortly, because he had been in the 57 times in charity wards of hospitals. The doctors had given him up. Medicine had given him up. Religion had no answer for him. And yet this particular day he cried out to a higher power, if there be a God, let him show himself now. And a higher power showed himself to Bill Wilson. What transpired in that room was called the spiritual experience, something I never had. But I'm here because of his spiritual experience. He was told that there was a way for him to stay sober, and that was by taking care of the individual that was so sick and desperately ill in front of him, while Bill was on his feet. He was told that if you take care of this individual, when he gets up, his gratitude will cause him to help you. And when the two of you leave here, leave together, don't look at them, stay together. You seek a 30th, a 4th, a 5th, a 20th, and all you gather together, I personally will take care of. From the high power to Bill Wilson 38 years ago, that's why I'm here, that's why you are here, whether you know it or not. There has been nothing new with the disease of alcoholism, except that wonderful miracle 38 years ago, to which we all owe our lives. Everything that we have, we owe to the higher power. There is a tremendous amount of confusion about the disease of alcoholism. Some people say it's a lack of willpower. Well, I say that anyone that thinks that the alcoholic has no willpower and that all that it takes is willpower, well, I would suggest to these people that the next time that they have diarrhea, that they should try willpower. See how that works. You hear the most asinine, stupid things about the disease of alcoholism. And the more that you hear, the more confused the alcoholic becomes. So I urge you one and all to take one of these papers that are up here. reprinted from a Philadelphia newspaper some years ago. They're not to be reprinted, of course. So up until this time, I've reprinted about 400 out. It's by Dr. Jeffrey A. Colton, Dr. Lester L. Coleman, M.D. And it's entitled, Speaking of Your Health, The Disease of Alcoholism. And it says, alcoholism is an actual physical illness that sometimes described as an allergy because it reflects a lack of tolerance to alcohol. It is not a mental illness. And bouts of excessive drinking commonly produce personality change in the alcoholic, which are too often mistaken as mental illness. And these temporary changes in personality are due to the chemical effect of alcohol and disappear when the alcoholic returns to sobriety. It goes on to say that the alcoholic differs from other drinkers not by the amount of alcohol he drinks, but by the body's chemical reaction to it. An habitual drinker who drinks because he chooses to is not necessarily an alcoholic. It goes on to say there is no cure. Once the tolerance for alcohol is gone, it can never be regained. But the disease can be completely controlled, and the only effective treatment for alcoholism is total and permanent abstinence. And it goes on to say that the members of Alcoholics Anonymous are the people that these alcoholics should associate themselves with. It goes on to say much more. So take a paper home with you. When somebody tells you that you're crazy, you know, or maybe you're a little slightly balmy in the head, say no. Would anyone tell you that you are anything but a physically sick individual who steal from you your life? They lie to you. This is not a mental illness. There is nothing mental about me. And yet I stand here and tell you that I'm an alcoholic. I have been in a mental institution, locked up 12 different times in straitjackets. And every time that I came out of the straitjacket, I was put in round blocks and square holes for many, many days. Doctor was asking me all kinds of stupid questions, and I was giving him all kinds of stupid answers. And we both laughed, but I stayed. He went home. And when they finally released me, they gave me a slip of paper that said this man is not mentally ill. He's simply an alcoholic and he shouldn't drink. But you see, he never told me how not to drink. And that in itself is a story. Because I wanted desperately with all my heart not to drink. But I couldn't live without it. And I had to drink in order to live. I had to drink in order to be like everybody else in the world. And we are, incidentally, only 5% of the world. They talk about minority groups. We are truly a minority group. Only 5% of the world are alcoholics. Yet they don't go around taking up collections for us or anything like that. A minority group of the minority groups, I would say. Well, you see, I was born like everybody else. There's been quite a bit of debate about that over the years. I was born just like everybody else. I had a mother, had a father, and I knew both of them. And I think for about 6 months they liked me too. Because I was one of 8 children, you know. And of the 8 children, I was the only one born an alcoholic. And of course, I wasn't born with a bottle stuck in my ear. And I couldn't be called an alcoholic at a very early age of 6 months. But I was an alcoholic. See, the doctors have a label for it. Now they call it chemically predisposed to be an alcoholic. Isn't that nice? That means in common language that there's something wrong with my system. And when I drink, I get drunk. That's all that it means. And if I don't drink, if I don't belong to AA, then I walk about the world full of fear, because this is the way that my disease affects me. First and foremost manifestation of the disease is ungrounded and unfounded fear. If you ask an alcoholic why are you so afraid, I don't know. And he's telling you the truth, he don't know. He is just one mass of walking fear. And the older he gets and the more stress and strain of life comes, the more the fear becomes and the more the feeling of inadequacy becomes, until one day, that no matter what age, he'll pick up a drink. Everybody picks up a drink. And he picks it up maybe as just a normal procedure. But he picks up a drink and he finds relief from fear and tension. And immediately he is now an alcoholic. Because that is the definition of an alcoholic. An individual who has a reaction from alcohol that a normal person does not have. He drinks alcohol, and he becomes what he would like to be but can't because of his physical body. So you take the kid in high school that's going to a dance, but he can't dance. He stands in the corner. And then one night someone says, why don't you go around the back? They got a jug of wine. He goes around the back, and here's the kid now that never could say anything. He wouldn't say spit if he had a mouthful. And this kid stands in the corner. He rolls himself into the woodwork. And now he goes out in the back, and someone gives him a glass of wine or a sip out of a bottle, and the next thing you know, he's the life of the party. He's standing on tables and dancing with the teachers and punching the big guys in the mouth. He is a holy terror. And the next day he wants to know, did I have a good time last night? And everybody tells him, sure you did. Man, you were a ball. Now he knows. Drink. And you can be like everybody else. Or there's a Chinese said 2,000 years ago. Man takes a drink, and the drink takes a drink. Then the drink takes the man. And pretty soon this individual is looking for help. He becomes a booze fighter. He hides bottles. He drinks and drinks and drinks and don't want to but does because he has to. The next thing you know, he's over the line. That's the story of alcoholism. Well, I was born full of fear, and I used to tremble when my mother went to the store and didn't come back immediately. And my father was an alcoholic. When he came home drunk, I hated him. And when he sobered it up, I loved him. And I was torn. And I went to school and I tried to be like my brother, and I couldn't. He got all A's and I got all Z's. And when the teacher would ask me a question, I would put my head down and I would get terribly red and tongue-tied. I couldn't speak. And people used to make fun of me and laugh at me. I sat in the corner and I hated everybody. I only wanted to be home with my mother. And I worried about my mother. What was my drunken father doing to my mother? Were they going to hit her? And I used to be so ashamed when men come around to collect the rent and my mother didn't have any money. And I used to hear her telling them, well, I'll come back next week. My husband is sick. And I used to say, what a terrible way. What a man. There's no part of a man. And yet when I would look at him, he was my father and I loved him and I begged him, please don't drink. And he would say, no, I won't. That's it. No more. And he meant it. God bless him. I know he meant it. And I would watch him. And I wouldn't go and skate like other kids. I would sit on the stoop and watch the corner for my father to come home. Because when he come around the corner a block away, I could tell you whether he was sober, whether he was drunk, whether he was drinking beer, wine, or whiskey. I knew. Just from the way he walked and the way he wore his hat. So you see, my life was possessed with alcohol. And I used to sit between my mother and father when he was drunk, keep them from injuring each other. And when time came for me to go to school the next day, I couldn't go. And everybody would eat a breakfast if they wanted breakfast. I would try to eat and I would throw up. I was so sick. And I used to pray in church and my father not to drink anymore. And I used to go to church and go to faith. Soon that wore off too. I didn't believe nothing. I didn't believe my father. I wouldn't talk to nobody. And I was right. Because you see, I was predisposed to be an alcoholic. And one day my kid brother and I were in a room because my father was drunk. My mother shoved us in there and got out of the way because I was a kid that would glare at my father. I wouldn't speak. But the hate was in my eyes, and when he would see me, he'd swipe at me, he'd kick at me. And I would curse him under my breath, and I'd say, someday you would get that will live. Terrible way for a 12-year-old boy to be. But I found relief. I would insist at this time that you remember. My brothers ate the same food, lived in the same atmosphere, slept the same bed, wore the same clothes, had the same mother, had the same father. But they were not like me. They were quite normal, my brothers and sisters. I was the only alcoholic. And this particular day in the bedroom, my brother went under the bed and came up with a gallon of wine. He said, look what I found, I can live it. He said, guess what the old man drinks? And he took the cover off it, he smelled it. He said, it smells good. What do you say, Jack? We try it. I said, all right, you try it first. See, my mother didn't raise no stupid children. And I didn't know what the hell it was, and I watched him closely, and he drank it. He said, oh, it's good, it's sweet. And he gave me the bottle, and I took a drink, and I thought I'd make it the same thing, but I didn't. Because with my chemical body, you see, when I drank that wine, the alcohol in it relieved me of all fears. And I felt good for the first time in 12 years. I didn't care if my father was drunk. I didn't care whether it was Saturday, Monday, or even better. I didn't care. I just felt good, period. And I looked at that bottle in amazement. I said, that's a miracle. And I said to my brother, have another one. He said, sure. He had another one. He said, yeah, that's good. And he was talking about what it tasted like. I was talking about what it did for me. And you know something? He stopped after two and I said, have a third. He said, no. And some 40-odd years later, now, my brother still takes two drinks. He don't want no more. But that particular day, I told him, I said, if the Lord made anything better than this, he must keep it up there. And I drank, and I drank, and the more I drank, the better I felt, and the better I felt, the more I drank. So you see, at age 12, without ever touching booze before, I was an alcoholic. I was born an alcoholic. And if you weren't born an alcoholic, that's all right too. That means, you know, not that we are both in the same place, because some people lose the tolerance a little later than others. They can drink for 5 years or 10 or 6. Doesn't matter. But once, as a good doctor tells you there, that the tolerance is gone, you are in, period. So I always liken alcoholism to a long, slow train ride. It starts down there, and it winds up there. And all along the way, there are stations. And you can get off any station that you want. And if you insist on going to the end of the station, then you will do exactly as I did. Because I went from there all the way down to there. And there are people that don't know things that I know. They have never experienced. And I say, thank God for that. Because there are people today that don't know what the inside of a jail is. I do. And there is no reason for you to go to jail to find out what it's like. If you see me after the meeting, I'll describe it to you in detail. And if you want to know what it is to do a lot of nasty things, I will tell you anything. Because it has to be this way. If everybody had to do what I did to get into this program, I wouldn't want to belong to it. I'd rather be dead. So you see, I need you as much as you need me, probably more. And I love to see young people come in. I love to see people come in and say, well, what is a straitjacket? They don't know what a straitjacket is. I say, how nice. They'll never have to experience it. So remember now your long, slow train ride. Where do you want to get off? If you are just a simple mind, a simple alcoholic, you are just as welcome here as the body derelict or the thief or anybody else that went to the end of the line. But remember, you're good. Remember you well. Don't look down your nose at those people that did go to the end of the line. Because Bill Wilson was a helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. And he stumped up a lot of doctor's offices. And nobody wanted him. And he was unemployable. And he went to the end of the line. And it's all because of this individual and higher power that we are all able to sit here tonight and call one another friend. How lovely. When I was 12 years of age, I wasn't thinking how lovely it was. I was just thinking how beautiful the wine was. And the first time I picked up a drink, I got drunk, I blacked out, and I passed out of the bathtub full of water trying to take a bath. And my beautiful mother woke me up on a Sunday morning, and she said to me, Jack, for God's sake, one in this family is enough. What are you doing to me? And they said, I don't know, what did I do? And she said, you drank almost 3 quarters of a gallon of wine. Then you passed out in the bathtub and almost drowned. And she said, Jack, I can't take two. One is enough, please. Don't ever be like your father. And you know something? I would never lie to her. But I lied to her that day. Because I promised her, Mom, I said, you know how I am. I wouldn't do anything to hurt you. I was a kid that I loved my mother dearly. My only one thought in life was to take that beautiful woman and pack her up some clothes and run. Buy a little house in Jersey somewhere, live with her, give her some of the things that she never had, and pay the rent for a year in advance, or maybe buy a house with a vino rent, and shower her with all kinds of food refrigerated, because I watched her trying to separate meat to slave to 8 hungry kids and a drunken father. And everything in my body cried out for that woman, you know, bring her a little relief and a little peace before she died. But Bruce was not allowed that. But I lied to her that day, told her everything would be alright. Stop crying, Mom. Stop crying, there'll be no more. But you see, I had found relief for the fear that I had. I found relief for the alcoholic that I was. And I wasn't about to give it up. The only thing that I did was start to scheme and plot. And I schemed and plotted where to get more to drink. And it was very simple for me, see, because I was an Irish Catholic. And if you're an Irish Catholic and 12 years old and an altar boy, you can drink. All you have to do is get the early mass and get there early. I had some of the best drink I ever had in sacristies. And I would get there about a quarter after 5, 4 to 6 o'clock mass. And by the time the priest got there, man, I was flying. And I could go to school that day, and I would tell a nun, you know, sister, why don't you sit down in the seat, and I'll take over the choir. I could do anything with a drink, anything. But I must have met a couple of alcoholic priests along the line, because they were getting there 5 o'clock, 4 to 6 o'clock. And that was a bad day. I would say, you don't play right, you know, that's dirty. That's dirty fool. Because there's nobody under 6 o'clock mass except two little old ladies with shawls around their head. They sit in the front, you know. They got to get to the 6 o'clock mass because they're afraid they won't make the day. It's just me and him and two little old ladies, and he's there gone and I'm dying. But it didn't last long. And I'm going to skip a little bit here tonight, and I'm going to tell you something. At age 16, I had been arrested several times. And at age 16, I came home one morning, and my mother found me at the shop and sitting in the kitchen with a gun to my father's head. Brought a whiskey on the table, a whole roll of stolen money, and I was threatening him. I was daring to take $1, take one drink, I'll kill you. Please do, I'll kill you. And my mother looked at me, that beautiful woman that she was, and she said, Jack, I don't know what I ever did to deserve you. Take your filthy money. And take your filthy gun and booze and get out of this house. We don't need you. We don't know where you came from, and please leave us alone. Your father there, he may not be the best father, but he's not like you. You're vicious. You have never done anything in this world that you were born except cause trouble and hurt people. Everybody that you came in contact with, you always hurt. Please, Jack, go away and don't come back no more. And I left home at 16. And if you think that I was a madman then, you should have seen me. Now I knew that the world was against me. My mother even turned on me. I hated with a vengeance that people wouldn't understand. Nobody would understand. I cursed God, and I went about my nefarious, vicious way. I ran with a mob on the west side of New York. And they were vicious, nasty people. And I will say this to you. I have hurt a lot of people. I've shot people, and I've been shot, and I've been stabbed, and I've driven cars at 110 miles an hour, getting away from cops, and I wound up in many, many serious predicaments. And I'm going to tell you something, only because I was drinking. I could never, ever do the things that I did without I was drinking. In fact, when I woke up in the morning, no matter where I was, in prison or a hospital or a jail or in the best hotel in New York or New Jersey, I always reverted back to being a 12-year-old scared kid. And that terrible fear the alcoholic knows always in my belly. And that terrible remorse. Why do you do it? Why don't you snap? You were not born for this thing. And I would hate myself so bad that I would pick up another drink to bury me. And as soon as I took that drink, I was no more than a 12-year-old scared kid. Now I was the vicious animal that I had been the night before, ready to do anything in the drop of a hat. So I lived a Jekyll Hyde existence. And I never wanted anybody to know that I was a 12-year-old scared kid. And I used to go about with a bunch of nasty people. And they used to look at me and accepted me because with booze I could be like them. And without booze I was nothing. So I'd wake up in the morning, take my morning drink, and go on another 24 hours. And it was always that way. 12 years old and scared, or a vicious animal capable of killing. And I tell you, I have some things in my past that I certainly wish were not there, but they are there in mind. And there are times that they come back to haunt me. I sit quietly on the edge of my bed and I can't sleep. And I go back over my past and I stand there. I thank God so much for the Opera House Anonymous program, because it allows me to smell my garbage no more. It stays with me, but now I've been able to turn it into something good, so that I can take out my garbage and parade it before you people, and yet you let you use it for your betterment. So this is what AA has done for me, and when these bad times come to me, and I sit on the end of my bed and I think of people, and I can still hear bones crushing whether I hit people would have gone across the bridge and those heads for taking their money. And I remember so much the open mouths and a feeling of horror when I stuck guns in people's bellies. And I loved it, because the world owed me something. And it wasn't enough that the horror in a man's eyes or the fear in his voice or the quiver in his hand as he handed me his money. I would back off and I would love him with all my might across the bridge of his nose. And I can still see the blood coming out of the corners of eyes. And there is no way that I can go back and undo what I have done. Nothing I can do about it. Except to tell you that that's what it means to me, and hope and pray to God that it never takes you to the same place. And if you think that maybe you're not having any trouble with alcohol, just stop and think. There was a time in my life, too, that I considered myself not to be having any trouble with alcohol. And I used to be in prisons and jails and hospitals and social workers and doctors who tried to help me. And they would say to me, Jack, you're a nice young fellow, why don't you stop drinking? And I would say to them, why don't you go to hell? Why does everybody pick on my booze? I can't live without drinking. If I don't drink, I sit in the corner, I can't do anything. I drink only in order to live. I drink only in order to operate. And they would look at me and they would say, you're helpless. I say, no, you're stupid. You don't understand what I'm saying. And they say, well, why are you so many times in jail? And I would say, well, I had a few bad breaks, you know. You win a few, you lose a few. And they would say to me, yeah, but you know, you seem to be losing all the time. You get out of one, you get into another. And it was true. They used to say about me on my street down in the village, you know, down in New York, if it was raining soup, Brennan would be out with a fork. And that's about the way it was. I couldn't get out of my own way. And you know what it is to stand up before a judge and listen very closely to try and find out what you're being accused of? It's a horrible, eerie feeling, but you can't talk about it. You can't say, I don't know why I'm here. But I never knew why I was there. And I used to lie, and I used to put on a sad face. And people tried to help me, but he couldn't. Because all they demanded of me was that everybody demanded of me, stop drinking. And I couldn't stop drinking. So I went my merry way, and trouble I had much. And there was no reason for me to go to trouble. I know that trouble. I had lots of trouble. And I used to look at people, and they'd say, you have a lot of trouble. I'd say, no. And they'd say, you're troubled with alcohol. I'd say, no. Alcohol is my friend. Alcohol is the only thing that sustains me. And I got married. And I went away to sea soon after I was married. Because I did not want my wife to see the 12-year-old scared kid that I was when I woke up in the morning. And I went to sea and I told her I'm going to sea because I need a rest. And she said, well, what about all your friends? You know, the way you work. She didn't know I worked with a bunch of thieves. And I said, well, they're nice people, but they don't need me. You see, I lost my first job by kind of alcohol. I used to be the wheelman for the mob. And you know, when I was a wheelman for a mob, and I'd get up in the morning, I would come down after my first drink, and I didn't know where we were the night before. And I used to start asking those stupid questions. How did everything go last night? But don't you know, you were there. You drove the car. And they began to get a little nervous. And they would say, my God, Jack, you know. And one day they said to me, you know, you are the best wheelman in the country, actually. You drive like one possessed. And it was true. I couldn't see that. Well, I knew it would go, and if it got my way, I guess I hit you. I don't know. But I drove like one possessed. I was possessed, there was no question. And he said, but Jack, old friend, you know, suppose someday, instead of taking her home, you might take off the briefcase. So he said, I lost my free job, my kind of boots. And then when I tried that way by myself, I got a lot of trouble. I was in Philadelphia one time, in the afternoon, and I stuck up an off-limits place, you know. It was an under-the-table joint. A lot of girls and a lot of bottles, and it was nice. I figured they can't make too much noise because they're illegal anyway. But, you know, I sucked the joint up and I got out. I knocked off about 35 of the patrons, cash register. And I got out of there with a brown paper bag and a stone car at the curb. A bag full of money, stone climb up the corner. And, you know, Philadelphia is all one-way streets. And I got up to the corner and said, one way, so you never break the rules when you're running. So I went down a one-way street, next one was one-way street. And pretty soon I was coming back, there's the joint, and just fucked up. And it was a big fathead cop in the middle of the road. And she said, get that thing out of here, we should have a pickup. I said, really? And I went around the corner again, the whole thing started again. Well, to make a long story short, I made my getaway on a bus. And there's a car down here in Philadelphia somewhere parked. It's got Jersey plates on it, and it's stolen. I left it there. I said, the hell with this place. I ain't been back in Philadelphia since, I'm kidding about something. This is the way things went. Then I went to see her, and I got married because she didn't go working out. I would stick up a joint, the guy had just gone to the bank. I was winding up with peanuts. And I was winding up in jail, all over the place, and I was arrested and imprisoned over 125 times. So you see, I wasn't doing too good. I wasn't making out really well. 50 cents an hour at a steady job would have been much better. But you see, I didn't know anything else, so I went to see to get away from my wife. She was starting to ask very embarrassing questions. Like, when are we going to pay the rent? And, you know, when are we going to eat? And I would say, God damn, I hope to get tangled up with one of these women. I want to eat and be normal. And so I went to see anyway. I sent a few bucks when I thought about it. And I went all over the world, and I got in trouble everywhere I went. I never saw anything except the freight bar or the hospital. Or the prison, one. Well, I got the freight bar, and by the street, got fine. It was just that simple. In the early days, you know, I was young and strong. I went to prison. The other guy went to the hospital. And then it changed. And he started to get up, and I started going to the hospital. And he started going to prison, see. So my time was about equally divided. And then, you know, I was on a ship one day, and I was having a cup of coffee, mulling over my situation, the lack of booze. So I had a thought about booze. I had a room full of booze, no clothes, just shoes. And there's booze, bottles of booze. And you know, all of a sudden I was swimming. And I don't swim. And I asked the guy next to me, a life jacket. I said, I'm gonna hold on. And he said, yeah, all right. I said, what the hell happened anyway? Where'd the ship go? He said, we got torpedo. And I said, what is that? And he explained that to me, and he said, you know, there's a war going on? I said, no, who's fighting? And here I am swimming in the water, and I said to him, I said, you know, God could get night over here. And he picked us up some 16 hours later, and he took us into England, you know, and gave me a choice. You want to fly home? Or you went on the ship? Now, if I flew home, I would have to go to work in the shipyard or something. I have to be home and then my wife would see me. I said, no, I'll wait for another ship. So I waited for another ship. And I stayed in the war for about 4.5 years. I got to feel so much more. And one day I had tremendous, tremendous blackout, out of insanity, because I drank myself sober. I couldn't get drunk anymore. And I realized where I was and what I was doing, and I just went completely berserk. And 16 days later, I come out of a coma. I had been fighting with prisoners in war. I fractured skull. My ribs were caved in. My arm was broken. My jaws were both wired together. And they just stared at my life. And the doctor said to me, that's all right, son. He said, we're almost in New York, you're going home, we're going to get arrested. And I said, no, not me. Don't send me home. Can you pack my papers and let me go? And he said, no, you're sick, you're going home. So I was forced to go home. I was forced to go home and live with a woman who didn't know me, didn't understand me, with the baby involved and her friend's son. And they tell me, shut that stupid kid up, he's always crying and I'm going out of my mind. And she would say to me, what kind of an animal are you? And I said, don't talk to me. Leave me be. Just buy me some whiskey and go away. That was my cry. I wanted to live in a corner and drink, because I couldn't live any other way. But she was determined that I was going to be saved. She went out, she learned about alcohol and alcoholism. And one day she came home to me, she said, you know something, Jack, you're not a return hero. I said, no, whatever. She said, you're a drunken bum. And I said, that's fighting words. And she said, you're an alcoholic, and I could help you if you want help. And I said, no, thank you. You'll help if I hold your other help. Stop drinking, right? She said, right. I said, wrong, I can't. So get the hell away from me, leave me alone with my booze. Stop trying to take it away from me. The only thing that I want, the only thing I need, the only thing I have, leave me alone with my booze. Take your kid, take yourself, take the money, take anything, and get the hell away from me, leave me alone. Let me drink. Helpless, hopeless, chronic alcoholic. Well, it wasn't to be, because she took me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. She bribed me one night. She said, if you want a drink, the only way you're going to get it is to come with me on the subway. Do you know what it is to ride on the subway drunk? Oh, my. That's an experience. That got more people into AA. Just riding that stupid subway from Brooklyn to New York. And I went to my favorite bar this morning, and I asked for a drink, and the man said, Jack, get out of here quick. What's the matter? He said, your wife was in here. And she said, if I give you a drink today, and she's going to blame my father. Jack, please, get off. I have a lot of kids to support. So I went to a little grocery, same thing. She shut me up all over the country. So I went home, and I said, what did she do to me? She said, I said, she good, didn't I? I said, yeah, you did, you rotten thing. And she said, you want a drink? And on the subway, I'll give you a drink. And she did, and I got the subway, I died. I got to New York, she gave me another one, I looked so bad. And she took me to an AA meeting, I sat in the back, and I said, what is this place? I said, you know, this is a Protestant church, I'm from these places. I'm an Irish Catholic. I've been in church for 20 years, I'm an Irish Catholic. And she said, shut up, you bum, sit down here, these people are going to help you. I thought, go help me. The guy got up here like I am up here tonight, you notice that? And don't take the free drink and you won't get drunk. And I said, you son of a bitch, if I get close to you, I'll kill you. I'll kill you. Because you see, I'm dying. Are you telling me funny stories? I know you can't get drunk if you don't drink. But that's not what I come here for. I want to know what to do. And the man said, put the cough in the bottle. I said, go to hell. That's not advice, that's stupidity. And I walked out of there with my wife and I left her. I said, get away from me. You're always hurting me. Leave me. And 4 days later, I wound up in a hospital. They took me off the streets in Brooklyn. Stark, raving mad, out of my mind, beat after that. They don't know to this minute who did it, but somebody did it. And I was a helpless, hopeless, gibbering alcoholic. And I woke up in Kings County Hospital in a straitjacket for the first time. And I like to die because now you see I was not the idiot they brought in the night before. Now I was a 12-year-old scared kid. And I lay there, I said, oh my Jesus, where are you taking me? What am I doing? What am I doing here? And the answer didn't come. Only the doctor. Soon he let me out. Soon he sent me home. And then one day I went home and my wife was determined. There's two cops in my apartment. He accused me of beating on my wife the night before, and I didn't even think I was home. She had marks on her throat, and I had to go around with the cops. I threw them down 2 flights of stairs. And they frowned on that, even in Brooklyn. And they went out and they got reinforcements. And they threw me down the stairs. And they liked it so good, they took me up and threw me down again. And then he took me out the back alley, and he popped me up a few walls. I'm going to tell you something. I'm blind in one eye. I don't hear out of one ear. My equilibrium is very bad. I've had 203 stitches just in that part of my right hand. I had my skull fractured twice. My Jordan and Wyatt together a dozen different times. My lizard and caveman, my lace and toes broken. And I would lay in a straitjacket and swear to God Almighty that I would have no trouble with alcohol. And every time I saw a car, I would say, stand there for just 1 minute. Let me get one drink. I have something to say. And I would get one drink and I would come out and I would punch him right in his mouth. They would take me in alleys and beat me half to death, stuff me in a jacket, and we'd go again. There was no end. And I would come out of the hospital and stand on the grounds of the hospital and I was ashamed to go. I couldn't go home. And I would stand for like a dock at night. And then I would sneak home and hope that there was nobody up, but my wife would be up. And I would say to her, you know, they're telling me who, she said, yeah, I see. How, what are you going to do now, Jack? I don't know. I really don't know. Because you know, see, I was 12 years old again, scared. I wouldn't hurt her. I wouldn't hurt nobody. I was just sitting in the corner. And she would tell the kids, get away from that man, you know, he don't feel good. And leave him alone. He's tired. He's sick. Don't make no noise. And she put a cover over the telephone so it wouldn't ring. And she would ask me, Jack, what are you going to do? I don't know. So he's sleeping alone. Let me just sit here. And my brother would come, and he was a big exuberant fellow, you know. He was so good and so nice. He used to go to church even when it wasn't Sunday. He was a nice guy. And he'd come in and he'd say, come on, Jack. Get out of the chair. I'll take you downtown, take you to the market, you know. I will buy you a job in one of the agencies. You can work. I said, Jimmy, I can't even cross the street. I can't get on the subway, I can't drive a car. Look at me, I can't hold my hand still. I can't go in and ask a man for a job. I said, I'm afraid to walk on the sidewalk. I can't even face a person. And he would say, but you're all right, are you in the hospital? You're out. I said, but I'm not all right. Don't you see inside? I don't know what's wrong. And my sister would come and she'd say, you dirty drunken bum. You dirty rotten, lousy lady bum. She said, my husband is working 2 jobs to support your family, and you sit there in the corner, and you say, I'm sick, I'm sick. Get off your ass and run for the job. I can't. What do you mean you can't? No understanding. So I would be baited back and forth, and the fear of the drink would keep me filled, and maybe grab us a claim. Next thing you know, I said to my wife, give me half a buck, once. She said, what for? I said, well, I can't sit here, don't you see? I can't sit here. I'm a man, I'm supposed to be out, I'm supposed to be waking, I'm supposed to be doing something, I can't take a quarter of the rest of my life and die. So give me half a buck, I was down the corner, I just had one beer, just one. And with that one beer, I could get on the subway, don't you see? And I could go to New York and look for a job at least. Or I'd borrow some money, I'd do something. But don't just leave me sitting here, give me something. So she gave me a very reluctant half dollar, maybe a dollar, out of her welfare check. And she said, please, Jack, you know, not again. I said, no, 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 no. And as God has told me, I didn't want nothing. Nothing except one drink so I would be able to maneuver. And I would go down to the corner, I would have one beer, and I would throw it in my mouth, it would hit my stomach, and it was like somebody turned the key in my head, boom. And I was a different individual. Completely different. Insane. And I would say to the bartender, don't put the bottle, put it back here. But you got no money, don't worry about it. Leave the bottle, or I'll kill you. And out of fear, they would leave the bottle. And then I would go out and look for a cop that had beat on me last week. And I would find a cop that didn't have to be the same one, anyone. And I would feed him on a mount. And the next thing you know, in the alley, be here to death with clubs again, bounced off walls from unconscious, stuffed in a straitjacket back in the hospital. Is there no end? Yeah, there's an end. Everything comes to an end. And I stood in court one day after my 12th lockup in the hospital. And my wife stood next to me and my kids next to her. And I said, what's going on? She said, you'll find out. Wait. The judge said to me, Jack, you knew me well. I've been here many times. He said, Jack, I got some news for you. I wouldn't sass him back now, because you see, I was 12 years old again and scared. I had ice water in my belly. And he said, the doctors have given out the prognosis on you, and it's not good, son. He said, you're a dead man. You don't know him. I said, Judge, please, tell me what you got to say and let me get out of here, because I don't like to stand in this court. And I said, please, I'm sick. Tell me what's wrong. And he said, Jack, the doctor said that you'll not live for the next 5 years. That if you do live, it'll be an insane institution. Because you're suffering from irreparable brain damage. And he said, it's impossible for you to know the difference between right and wrong. He said, you'll never ever work another day in your life. And he said, they say too that you're a homicidal maniac. And that maybe perhaps some night you might wipe your family out overnight, not even though you did it. So he said, we have to do something, don't you see? I said, yeah, I know. And he said, we're going to remove you from your home for protecting your children. So he removed me from my home. And on the way out the door, he said to my wife, is this what you want? She said, yeah, that's what I want. Because by this time I had two children, boy and a girl. And she got up real close to me, and I'll never forget that terrible hatred in her face. And she said to me almost the same thing that my mother said. You've never done anything in this world but hurt everybody you've ever come in contact with. Get out of our lives and leave them alone, you dirty rotten bum. These kids are going to get a chance to live without you. You're not going to spoil their life. Mine you spoil, but you won't spoil theirs. Because if you come back to where I'm living with my children, the judge gave me custody of his children now. If you come near our home, I'm going to put a knife in your belly. I'll kill you. Like somebody should have killed you a long time ago. You're useless. So they took me out of there and threw me over the turnstiles in the subway. And they said, hey, Bum, don't come back to Brooklyn. We had you up to the eyeballs. I have never yet heard anybody who was ever thrown out of Brooklyn. As far as I know, I'm the only one. I went to New York and I was full of, you know, alcoholic delusions. I was going to get a gun, I was going to go here, I was going to knock off a couple of joints, I was going to make good score here. No. No. Who's that taking its toll? I was nothing, like the cop said. I was nothing. I went to New York and I didn't know nobody on Mulberry Street no more. I didn't know nobody on Mark Street. I wound up in a Bowery in New York. And I lived on a Bowery for about 2 years, maybe 2.5 years, never had to recommend. And I'm going to tell you what it's like to live on a Bowery. Never, never land. You see those people down there now, they don't feel anything. Nothing. They're not there. They were somewhere in Hawaii. They're not in Bowery. They don't know anything what's going on around them. It's just existing. And that's where I live. And I used to walk around the streets and walk a dead man. And the only thing I knew was to hate and curse God. And I cursed a higher power every time I opened my eyes. Because you know how it is on Sally, you know, you lay there and you come to. And I wouldn't sleep nowhere except in the street. I slept in the snow, cold, hot. I fell down subway stairs and I ripped my head 1,000 times. And I didn't even know I was bleeding. And yet by trucks and buses and automobiles. And I was beaten and I felt nothing. Only one thing I felt. Why didn't the guy upstairs take me? And every time that I woke up and I would smell myself before I opened my eyes, I'd say, oh my God, no. I can't be here. Later I'll close my eyes, I'll wake up, I'll be somewhere else. It's only a bad dream. No, I wasn't a bad dream. Or there, now. And when I finally was forced to wake up and look at the day, look at the night, whatever happened to be, I would curse God. And I would say, you dirty rotten thing, Jesus to me. Well, I would have it on like this, and one day I had hemorrhage in the stomach, and that hemorrhage was so bad I was in a filthy toilet trying to take a drink, and I couldn't. Because I took a drink, half of my stomach would come up. I was so weak, I fell on my hands and knees, and I hooked my chin on the bowl. And if God is above me, I literally watched myself running down the toilet bowl. And I said to myself, why do I fight it? Why am I fighting? I want to die. Let me die. And I drew the bottle over my shoulder, and I said, I am having trouble with alcohol. For the first time in my life, I would admit that alcohol was my struggle. And I drew the bottle over my shoulder, and I said, let me go. And I lay there fully expecting them to walk out. but the man upstairs had different ideas. But while I lay here and watched myself fall down, another Neverland came back. I was home with my children, playing in the yard, and I was on a ship, and I was everywhere, and then suddenly, you know, reality come back to me. And I was back at that AA meeting I had been with my wife that I really choose. And I saw those nice people. It was like I was in the light above their head looking down, everybody milling about, drinking coffee, talking, like these people. And I said, oh my God, Jackie, how did you blow it? And I must remember what my mind was like. Very incoherent. And snatches of this and snatches of that. Because the doctors were right, I was completely gone in the head. I didn't know anything about anything. Didn't know who was the president, what year it was, what my name was, but I heard nothing. But that picture came back to me so clear, and I know now that it was a man up there that put it there. And I said, my God, if only it were me too late. And I said, why didn't I listen when I had the chance? And then something inside me said, maybe, maybe, possibly. And I said, oh my God, could it be that I could go to AA now? That was my cry of despair. That was my bottom. And I hope that you don't have to go that far to admit that your problem is alcohol. And I crawled out of there 7 hours later on my hands and knees. And I made somebody understand what I was trying to say. Because my mouth was all infected, my teeth were kicked up into the roof of my mouth, my throat was very bad, I was almost blind in both eyes. I had body light, I had that on the back of my neck, I was filthy dirty. All I owned were a pair of pants and a shirt and a pair of slippers I had on my feet. A human wreck, mentally, physically, and spiritually. Somebody, I don't know who, said, all right, I'll call AA for you, sit down and wait. And then he came back in a little while and he said, they're coming, don't go away. Because the alcoholic and the bodily have the habit of moving and don't know he's moving. So I had to forcibly hold myself there and keep myself alert and say, they're coming, they're coming, they're coming. And then reassure myself every few minutes. Maybe it was a dream that I had. Maybe I didn't even speak to anybody. But my sponsor did come and his wife with him. And when he tells you that there's no religion here in AA, let's believe it. Because I thought surely the guy that came for me would be named Kelly. Had to be an Irish Catholic, right? There's nobody else in the world, just Irish Catholics. If you were anything else, when I sucked you up, I didn't even give you coffee. You didn't count. But if you were an Irish Catholic, at least you got coffee and coffee at home. So I knew that the guy coming in the door had to be a big Irish Catholic. Kelly, Brennan. My sponsor came in the door and he said, oh my God. And I looked at him, and he said, my name is Sam Cohn. And I'm here to help you. And let somebody tell me that this is an Irish program. No, there is no religion in AA, just it is love. And I looked at this man, and I said, can you help me? He said, oh my, yes. And I see, he was either the biggest damn fool that walked the face of the earth, or he knew something that a lot of people didn't know. Because you know something? He says to me, if you come with me and Gene, and you come to AA, you don't have to drink no more and you'll be alright. And I thought of what the doctor had said. And he said, no, I don't care. If you come with me and Gene, and you'll be alright and you won't have to drink no more. And I said, are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. And I looked in his eyes and that man knew. And I looked at his wife and she was holding her hand over her mouth. So I think maybe she thought that I was going to scream or something. And she said, he wouldn't fool you, Jack. Will you come with us? I said, yeah, I'll come with you. And he took me one under each arm and he didn't care if I had 50 body lights or one. And he carried me to AA. And you know something? I didn't have to drink no more, and I'm all right. Isn't that amazing? And it was 25 years ago, 25 years, that I've been privileged to come to AA and partake of a beautiful program guaranteed to work. 3 doctors said I wouldn't make 5 years. 2 of them are dead. And when I see the other guy, he don't look well. He don't look well at all. And I always tell him, Doug, why don't you take care of yourself? And he tells me, Jack, you're a miracle. I know. But you still should take care of yourself. Because those normal people, they need you. And I grew. And I found what I was looking for in the bottom of a bottle all my life. I found right here in AA. Understanding. Because nobody ever said, get that bum out of here. Think of that. No. They would say, sit down, Jack. We need you. And they would give me a cup of coffee. He said, you want a drink? You know, I'll speak with you. It's all right. Because Jack will pick up a cup of coffee. I had to bend over and wrap it up like a dog, and nobody stood to watch me. I couldn't hold anything in my hands. And little by little, I got stronger. And little by little, people said to me, Jack, keep coming. God damn it, you're going to make it. You just keep coming and keep your faith, and you'll be all right. And we need you so bad. And I couldn't understand what they were talking about. And I asked Mike Bonson one day, I said, hey, how come that, you know, that these guys come to me, they need me? He said, oh, Jack, we do need you. We use you. They use me. How? He said to me, he said, you know what, when we get a new person in, we will sit him next to you. And we tell him that if he keeps drinking, he's going to get my son. And he said, you're helping an awful lot of people. And I was so happy. You see, because my disease affects me mentally, physically, and spiritually. My one disease affects me mentally, physically, and spiritually. Mentally, it disrupted my mind completely. I was capable of anything. But spiritually, it robbed me of my spirituality. And what is that? It's nothing to get excited over like a lot of people do here in AA. You say, I want to be spiritual in church. No. There's no religion in AA. Didn't we tell you that? My sponsor told me that, and I knew it, because he was a Jew. And he had no confession to go to. And he was sober. And with my brothers and sisters, my father, nobody would come near me. He came. And he gave me what I had. My life. And he said, there's no religion in AA, Jack. But there is spirituality. And I said, what is that? And he said, well, you know, a person that's spiritual is wanted and needed and loved. And he said, when you're an alcoholic, nobody wants you, needs you, or loves you. Unless they're real hard up. And he said, even that goes there for a while. Nobody needs you, wants you, or loves you. So you come into AA, and we need you. And we want you. We want to look at you and watch you grow, so we'll know we're in the right place. And he said, we love you. And he said, now wait a minute, you know. Tell me about that love thing. Because you're a man, you know, I'm the man, I don't know. So what are you, some kind of, you know? And he said, no. He said, Jack, we love you because you're an alcoholic. Just think about that for a little minute. We love you because you're an alcoholic. Now I want to ask you in all fairness. Did anybody ever love you because you were an alcoholic? Even your mother? No. They loved you in spite of you being one. But they didn't love you because you were one. So I said, oh, I understand that. And then he told me a lot of things, this man. The simple little Jewish man. Beautiful he was. One day I went in and I said, I ruined my life. He said, you're crazy. Get the hell away from me. He was a nasty little Jew, too. And I used to tell him, if you knew better, I'd bash you, you know, thing. You talk to me funny. I don't like you talking to me like that. He said, well, might you smart? Nothing stupid. And I said, well, I'm trying. He said, well, try a little harder. Because, you know, you got learning. I'm going to be writing all the time. So I said, well, I still owe you my life. He said, no, you don't. So what I did for you was done for me. And the guy that did it for me had it done for him. And the guy that did it for him had it done for him. And you go all the way back 38 years, the higher power did it for Bill Wilson. So if you owe anything to anybody, go to the higher power. Go say thanks to him. I said, you stink. You know I don't talk to him. He says, shame on you. He loves you so well. He sent me out to get you, a rotten thing, and now you say you can't talk to him. I said, he really sent you out for me? He said, sure. Who the hell do you think of? The head of the whole business here is God and higher power. And he said, you better make a peace with him. Because the guy that feels so much gratitude has got his way somewhere. And I ain't gonna take it from you. Oh, with you, you don't owe me nothing. You're too nasty anyway. So that night I made my peace with the man upstairs. I didn't ride home on the bus that night. I walked home. And when I walked home, you know, I let them upstairs. The eye today, friend, you know, she sent that nasty little Jew out after me. You must think a lot of me for something to drink. I don't know why. I heard a lot of your citizens down here, but, you know, I was drinking. But I said, now I tell you something, from here on it's going to be different. And if you tell me what to do, I'm going to do it. I don't care what it is. You tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And you've been telling me what to do for the past 25 years. And you know, sometimes I say to him, well, all right, I'm going to do it. But I'll get you right. And if you get in any trouble, don't come praying for me. But you know something? He knows wrong. He knows what the hell he's doing. And sometimes he's dead wrong. But I do it anyway, because I've learned from hard, cold experience. If I keep my hands out of the mess, it'll get better. After 5 years, my wife came back to me. She asked me to come back home to live with her, the man and wife. And I did. And the result of that was a terrible ordeal on my part. I had to learn how to live. I had to go back into my home and sit down with kids that I didn't know and learn how to eat with a knife and fork. I sit down in the basement with my wife, and she used to teach me how to pronounce words, because my mouth was so badly distorted that I couldn't speak properly. I had to get my mouth operated on a couple of few times. My wife taught me how to speak. My little girl taught me how to eat. And my son used to look at me and he taught me how to play ball a little bit. And everybody was so good to me. Everybody taught me so much. My wife was of a different religion than I was. And one day she said to me, I've been talking to that guy, he's a home dear, and down his father is a fine friend, and he has a home. I took him home for a little bit. He happened to be a very religious individual. He spoke to my wife while I was out working. And one day she said to me, Jack, I'm going to adopt your religion because I believe in you and it. She went up to the church and she was converted. I was able to go back to church. My two children were baptized the same day on the altar in OLTH in Brooklyn. And in OLTH in Brooklyn, when we were in the basement, I attended AA meetings, miracles. And then one day she said to me, I'm going to have another baby. Oh, I said, thank God. I had asked my friend upstairs too. I felt that I had been cheated on the first two. But they were grown up without me, and she raised them, and I was just so worth another kids. Kids to me are the nearest thing to God. And here along came this little guy, and my little AA baby. And he'd be 19 years old on Labor Day, September 6th. And I look at him, and I see God. I look at him, and I see my wife. And I look at him, and I see all the people in AA. This is what we're raising. We people in AA, or younger generation. Beautiful children. He has an understanding that's so deep, it's amazing. He's a National Merit Scholarship winner. He goes to a small college in Pennsylvania, Harvard College in Pennsylvania. He came out the top 0.5% of the country in the National Scholarship Merit Contest. 0.5% from the top. I thank God for AA. I thank God for all that He has left me. I thank God for all that He has taken away from me. And I want to tell you something. This program works. I'm standing here, the walk and talk of miracle and instrument of a higher power. And I tell you that anything that I say is so true, comes from my heart. And if I can be sober and happy, you can be sober and happy too. Life is all not good, and nothing ever so good. And I have my ups and I have my downs. And I left my wife on January 22nd of this year. I had to cancel my only meeting ever in my 25 years in Midland, Texas. I stayed home that Friday because my friend upstairs had upset me so I didn't know what was going on. And during that night, instead of being in the middle of Texas, I was home and my wife complained, pains in her chest. And from 1 o'clock in the morning till 5, I waited in an emergency room. The doctor came out and told me she's dead. And it was just that sudden. And I said, my friend upstairs, I said, I don't know what you're about. For the moment, I said, I'm a little confused. But I trust you. Because you're so good to me, and you've been good to me, and I know damn well that you're not going to hurt me. And I don't know what you're doing, but it's all right. And I said, thank you, Mary, for taking the foot quickly. And I went outside the parking lot in the cold winter's morning, and I stood without a shirt and without a coat. And I thank God for being able to take the blows that life is and come up smiling, at least smiling in my heart. I went out to Pennsylvania and I picked up my boy and I come home and I said, John, we both were hunting now and he just buried here for me with your mother. I said, she was my life. Everything I ever did was to her. She wrote my letters, she made my phone calls to remind me of appointments, she fed me, she calmed me down, she explained things to me. And suddenly I was all alone. And you know something? My daughter came back to me and I said, Jack, you'll never be alone. And 3 days after she was buried, I went to another trip and I went to an AA meeting and another convention. And I want to thank all you people, everywhere in AA, for letting me share myself with you, because I take away more than I believe. It's a beautiful life. I expect that one day I'll die too. And I have a little hole up there next to my wife. It's a tombstone with my name on it. It's a Jack and Rosburn. And on it, because it says that her time was given to others. And now she lives every time of life. Please God, one day I'll join her. Beloved mother, wonderful wife. I'm not unhappy. I'm a very happy individual. And I love AA with all my heart because I know that I've been allowed to stay on this earth many, many more years than I should have. And I stay here and I thank you to feel that the faith that I have is yours for the essence. Take as much as you need. I have enough for all of you. I want to thank those people for inviting me down here. I want to tell you that when I get up in the morning, I don't make one move until I send my little prayers for the secret. And it goes that I meet my God in the morning when my day is at its best. And His presence comes like sunrise, like a glory in my breast. And all day long His presence lingers, and all day long He stays with me. And we see Him in perfect colors for a very troubled sea. So I think I know the secret when from any troubled way. You must seek Him in the morning if you want Him throughout the day. And when I say that little prayer, I'm ready for anything. And I thank God for giving me one more day to live in. And with that, I'll thank Gary and all those nice people. They've marched up down here. To that one individual that I was speaking to. Have faith. God does love you. And I'll leave you all now with a little blessing. I love so well. May the roads rise with you. And may the wind always be at your back. And may the sun gently warm your face and the rain softly fall on the fields. And until we meet again, may the good Lord hold us all in the hollow of His hand. Thank you and God bless you.